From Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. When you stand alone, naked, in front of a full-length mirror, what do you see? Are you beautiful? Handsome? Or do you think you're fat? Old? Ugly? Let's be honest about our bodies this hour, okay? So we're going to jump right in with photographer David Jay. Anne Strainchamp spoke with him about his SCAR project.
David, I wanted to start by just asking you how this project came about. Was there a genesis?
Yes, I started shooting this SCAR project about 7 years ago when I was living in Australia, when a very dear friend of mine was diagnosed with breast cancer. She was about 30 at the time, and within perhaps 2 weeks, they had done a mastectomy on her. And it was really shocking, of course. And when I saw her soon after the mastectomy, I knew I would have to photograph her again. I had known her since she was 17 and taken her picture many, many times throughout her life. And this was such a pivotal moment, this mastectomy. And I really just felt, well, perhaps as a photographer, shooting these images is my way of dealing with my own issues about it, my own fear, my own need to examine it, I guess, and to come to terms with it. At that point, there was no SCAR project. There was no intention whatsoever. I just really wanted to take Paulina's picture.
We should talk about some of your images. I've got your book right here. There's this one I wanted to ask you about. Emily. Yeah, Emily's 32, and this is the photograph you took that kind of went viral. It was the lead photo in a slide series you put out, and this was the one I saw on so many people's Facebook pages. She's pregnant, and she's had a radical mastectomy, bilateral. She's missing both breasts, and she's just looking straight out at us. I don't know, how would you describe her?
Oh, Emily was, it was quite an honor to shoot her, just in her very revealing nature. She was so comfortable standing there. And the fact that she was pregnant gave the image and the message that there was more at stake here and more beauty as well, perhaps, you know, that life goes on after this, that something very devastating has occurred, yet there's this beauty of life that continues.
Was it hard for you to see these women's bodies as beautiful?
No, not at all. I mean, they are beautiful. They're my greatest fear was that perhaps some woman in Arkansas, Oklahoma, California would look at this picture of this beautiful woman with breast cancer and think, sure, that's fine for you. I don't look like that. Mm-hmm. Not realizing that she looks exactly like that. But my experience as a fashion photographer and moving the lights around and the shadow around and putting a filter on the light so her skin that's been ravaged by radiation and chemotherapy now looks smooth, and the shadows on her belly and her thighs now make her appear thin, where in fact she's just normal, or in fact perhaps put on weight from the hormonal treatments that they've had to endure for part of the process of dealing with the cancer. And the pictures are definitely more honest and more raw, but they expose an even deeper beauty, which is the whole point. There's a much deeper beauty there than this superficial vision that, you know, the media serves up.
How did the women respond to seeing their own photos? I'm thinking of one in particular. Wait, it's right here. Sarah. She's 28.
Oh, yes.
She's looking straight at us, and there's this harsh, just jagged scar that runs straight across both breasts, and her nipples are gone. And she's so young. She's 28. Her face looks absolutely vibrant and beautiful. But there's this, if you look closely, there's this one tear slowly trickling down her face. What was going on?
Yeah, that's quite a moving portrait. And Sarah had come to New York, and she had come along with her girlfriend. And we did a shoot, and she was not crying. It was just a very honest shoot, standing in front of the camera. And, you know, we shot away for a half hour or so, and I got some images that I was pretty pleased with. They just seemed very direct and very honest. And I thought, okay, I think we've got something good here. And I was shooting this on digital, and I sat down at the computer and loaded the images into the computer and pulled them up on the screen. And I said, Sarah, why don't you come over and have a look at this and see what you think? And she came and stood right behind me. And I started scrolling through some of the images, and I turned around, and there was just, you know, tears streaming down her face. And I said, okay, now we take a picture. So I kind of dragged her over to the window and snapped off about three frames, and that's the picture that you see hanging in the exhibition. And it's about 5 feet tall, and there's a beautiful little tear trickling down her face and one on her shoulder, and it's a very honest moment, a very, very honest moment.
For me personally, these are really beautiful photographs. They're everything you said. They're really beautiful photographs. They're also frightening photographs. For me, as a woman, I'm in my mid-50s, and I've never seen women's bodies after they've had surgery for breast cancer. I've never seen a woman's body with her nipples removed. I've never seen a woman's body with huge kind of puckered scars across where part of her breasts or all of her breasts used to be. It's scary, and at the same time, it sort of feels good to actually see what can happen, I guess, because it's less scary if you can see what can happen. So that's my first initial reaction, is dealing with the shock and the fear. And then the next thing that comes is seeing the beauty and the courage in a lot of these women's faces. So anyway, for me,
yeah,
thank you.
No, I think that's a really valid perspective, and I think it's one that most people share when they look at the images. No one has seen what it looks like. We don't allow it, you know.
Right, unless you know a woman with breast cancer who you're close enough with that you're likely to see her without her clothes on, you won't have seen this.
I've received thousands of emails from women all over the world. And what was so interesting to me and so disturbing at the same time was the commonality of these emails and what their message was and what they wanted to say to me. So many of them said something very similar. They would often start out with, I'm a 30-year-old woman, I'm a 40-year-old woman, I'm a 60-year-old woman. And then they would go on to say, you don't know me from Adam, but someone had sent me the images of the Scar Project, and I just wanted to say thank you, because I have breast cancer, and I had a mastectomy last year, 5 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago. And since that time, I've never got undressed in front of my husband again. My children have never seen me naked. I feel like I'm a monster. I feel like no one in the world looks like me. And I received so many of those emails. It was so saddening to think that these women have felt like that about themselves for so long. How, feeling like a monster because you've had a mastectomy, being too embarrassed to get undressed in front of your husband, not allowing your children to see you for fear that it might scare them. It's really upsetting, isn't it? And very sad. And I think they found... The flip side of that is that I think that these women have found some peace in the Scar Project. They've seen these other women who have looked just like they do. And when they look at the pictures, they too feel love, and they think the woman is beautiful. And I think they think, you know what? If she's beautiful, maybe I'm beautiful too. And maybe when people look at me, they'll still love me. And I think that's the beauty of the Scar Project right there.
David Jay's powerful photos from the Scar Project can be seen on our website at ttbook.org. Anne Strangechamps spoke with him.
What's your name?
Caleb.
Caleb. Faisal, nice to meet you. How'd you like it?
Just brought down a lot so my waves stick out and get a fade.
Do you want it all the same level?
Yup.
And we'll fade the side slightly?
Yup, in the back.
That sounds really familiar. Charles, where are we?
Well, Jim, what you're hearing is the sound of a barbershop here in Madison. It's called the Atwood Family Barbershop. It's where I get my haircuts down the street from my house. But I went there a couple days ago to talk to Faisal Abdul Allah. He's a London-based artist. In fact, he's the artist in residence at the University of Wisconsin here.
So why is an artist in a barbershop?
Well, Faisal's also a barber in London. In fact, he gets all of his inspiration from the barbershop for his art. Sorry. And if you'll notice from his accent, he's a Jamaican immigrant to London. And for me, I thought it would be best to talk to him in a barbershop to kind of get the vibe of where his work comes from.
I just sound like your accent.
Faisal was in a documentary recently that asked a big question. What does a haircut mean to a black man? Here in Madison, everyone at the barbershop seemed to have something to say about that question. I start with Faisal himself, though, who was, by the way, cutting hair the entire time I spoke.
I think the haircut is the alpha and the omega. For me, it's probably one of the most kind of, because like the hair is like the crown, isn't it? The hair kind of sits on top of your head. I think issues of representation and identity have been played out in my own life when I was very young. And my father was always keen about his identity, his look, of how he was kind of perceived by, you know, the kind of the host community in London. So representation for me was very important. Always had polished shoes, always wore a suit, always was groomed. And in some ways, you know, being groomed was very much a part of your understanding of self, body knowledge, and understanding what your aspirations are. So for me, the haircut was a very, very important kind of detail in one's own makeup. So for my father, it was haircut and shoes. So once those two things were in place, he believed that you could go out into the landscape and do incredible things. So that's what how I would frame the idea of the haircut.
The barbershop we're in right now is in my neighborhood. It's intimidating. It's an intimidating space, right? Where I'm surrounded by white people, I'm surrounded by that culture, and then suddenly I look in through this glass window and I see not just a bunch of black people, a bunch of black men. Do you think the black barber should care? Or do you think that maybe that's a space that we need, that white people need to be introduced to maybe find out some truth?
Race is not my problem. Race is, in some respects, the white man's problem. So when I go into Wells Fargo or Chase Bank, or if I walk into Macy's and I get the furry eyeball treatment from the security guard, it's their problem, not mine. They feel I might be coming in there to maybe take something. They create environments that are not conducive to what I feel comfortable with. And I don't see them, you know, trying to create a space that black people feel, you know, cool about. So why should we be conscious about the issue of race? Because all we're doing is just a trading space where you come in, you get a haircut. Now, if in your own makeup you believe that there is something inherently different about a black guy cutting your hair, that for some strange reason he's going to remember civil rights and probably take your neck off, you know what I mean? This is not this is not Sweeney Todd. This is like, you know, this is a space where we want to earn money. You want to earn money. So if you want to come in and you want to sit down, read a paper, get your hair cut, I'm cool in the gang with that. It's not a problem. Back in the 70s, the white guys would come in the barbershop and they would they'd sit down and you could see them feeling uncomfortable. And they would always say, I'm just going to get a newspaper. That would be the line they would always use in the 70s. And the white guys would go and get a newspaper and they would never come back. It's like an escape.
But at the same time, like, you're coming in to get a haircut, but I know, like, for me, I work at UW. A barbershop is one of the few places I can come around and be surrounded by black men, like when I go to church and when I go anywhere else.
Yeah.
So I'm not really ready for a whole bunch of white people to just walk up in the barbershop. Even the fact that I came here this morning, thought I was going to start my day off with some black guys, and y'all walked in. And all of a sudden now, Madison, the city, the white city that it is invaded my space. Do white people need to, that question is complicated, because do white people need to come and learn some truth? Hell no, they need to come and get a haircut. But the idea that like that's putting black people, black men on an exhibit if white people are coming in to get some kind of truth. Nah, I'm here to get a fade, and I'm also here to not see white people for a little bit. But so you coming in to learn something about yourself or about your world is not just complicated, it's fucked up. So yes.
And I think what Dennis has said is very illustrative of the barbershop. It's a space where true issues are discussed. And like I said, sometimes it's sweet, in the mouth and it's bitter in the belly. But it's you know, that's his reality. And I think we can never run away from that. And I think what I love about the barbershop, it doesn't try and sanitize it. Not at all. But the barbershop space is a space that, you know, explores all of those different possibilities in a very honest and open way.
So you're obviously a world-renowned artist. You're also, in certainly in your neighborhood, a renowned barber. How is being a barber and an artist connected?
I mean, essentially, you know, kind of artists work with ideas, you know, and there is some kind of dissemination, there is some kind of output. Now, our understanding of artists is that I'm this guy that wears a beret with a thin mustache, and I create these wonderful paintings that are, you know, I throw things around, I throw paint around. No, you know, it's about ideas. And what I'm doing now is a form of sculpture. So I'm actually sculpting hair. I'm actually sculpting the material. And I keep sculpting that material until it has a kind of a beautiful aesthetic. And then this aesthetic is then appreciated by an audience. But whilst I'm doing my sculpting, the subject is alive. The subject has a voice, has a personality. And that subject then tells me stories about themselves, about the issues that they're currently dealing with, whether they be about race, whether they be about privacy. And I think that is too much to be allowed to just go into the walls and disappear. So what I try to do, I try to grab some of those kind of ideas and sentiments and deposit them into works. If you put aside the process of how you make a fade, and think about the person, think about the subject. You know, they get a fade because of vanity, hygiene, body knowledge, a kind of sense of pride, the idea of image consciousness for me is the number one thing, that individuals are very conscious about how they look, and having that fade is a global aesthetic. So when you go to the airport, you always see people that have been to the hairdressers, because they always get their haircut before they fly. So you always see the good fades in the airport. You know, you always see the good fades at weddings. You always see the good fades sports stars on the TV. In areas of importance, you always find good grooming. So it doesn't surprise me that that consciousness is global, because I can sit at home and I can see what Kobe Bryant looks like now, or what Jay-Z looks like now, or what Aaron Lennon playing for Spurs looks like globally, and they all look the same.
Do you, I mean, you've been doing art for quite some time. Is all your art ideas coming from the barbershop?
So, yeah, I mean, I can honestly say that. I remember I did a talk at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London, a very well-known museum, and they said to me, you know, what comes first, barbering or making art? And I said that if I stopped making art, barbering, if I stopped barbering, I wouldn't make any more work, because that's where the work comes from. It comes from, look at Terry, he's performing. If people were to come into the shop and he weren't talking, they'd be like, what's wrong with Terry? What's wrong with him? Because he's performing, that's what he does. And I think being a barber is a part of that performance. And you have to be the broker. You bring somebody in and somebody has a debate and you say, no, you're wrong. You know, and it's an interesting place to be. You're almost like the kind of, well, in some ways, he's the artist. And the customer is the subject. And you have an audience. So in some ways, I think it's a really kind of interesting relationship that takes place, whereby, you know, I mean, look at it now, you know, in the next 20 minutes, they might travel the world 8 or 9 times, you know, and they may disagree, and he may stop cutting, and he may, like, you know, walk around and prod somebody, but in some ways, you know, that's the magic of the space, you know.
Because
she cut their hair.
But on the reverse end, as somebody's just getting their hair cut, like, there's a form of trust that has to be there. Like, I'm not gonna let just anybody cut my hair. Like, I have to trust you, I have to kind of, maybe not know you, but I have to, like, I know, there's some form of connection that has to be there for me to let you, like, touch my hair. Because you control my whole future then, like, a bad haircut, I'm not gonna get the job, I don't know. So, as somebody getting their hair cut, it kind of forms the connection as it is. So five times, six times haircut, like a connection is formed and solid then by that time. So
I can imagine, because if positive things happen to you from your hair, your girlfriend says, oh my God, I love your haircut, get the job, then you can see the relationship form. Mm-hmm. But you don't know Faisal,
right?
You just met him today.
Yup.
Are you nervous?
I'm not. I'm looking at his hair and I'm getting a good vibe from him, so.
Okay, there you go. There you go.
He knows. His hair looks good.
I'm going to ask these guys a few questions when I come back.
So you can see Faisal Abdu'Allah's photos and prints on our website at ttbook.org. Faisal's art studio and barbershop are in London. TT Book producer Charles Monroe Kane spoke with Faisal at the Atwood Family Barbershop, owned and operated in Madison, Wisconsin, by barber Terry Moss.
Your parents always tell you, you dress nice. You know, absolutely. You dress how you want to be. You want to be the best. So you have the best.
I mean, you can get your hair cut at Terry's shop or at any black barbershop, you know, obviously for the culture. There's not too many places that you can go where you're going to see, you know, a group of black guys in one spot that's, yeah, able to talk and just give each other the business, whether they know each other or not. I mean, because I know I come in here, I talk crazy to everybody. Yeah,
it's free. You know, you feel free here. You know, it's
ain't no cops.
Oh, right.
You know, yeah, what do you mean, police officer?
We probably getting harassed if we was outside. Come
on. Now you ain't going to say nothing no more.
I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. There are a lot of ways we identify ourselves, where we come from, a race, a religion, but maybe nothing shapes our identity more than, are you a man or are you a woman? Even that can get really complicated, though. Independent producer Aubrey Ralph explains.
Most people feel like they belong in their bodies. They feel like they fit, but imagine what it would be like if you never felt that way. If you always felt that you were born in the wrong form, like hydrogen trying to be water without oxygen. That's how many transgendered people feel all the time.
I think the earliest age I can remember would be like 4-ish or 5-ish, when I was starting to be around more kids at my age. I started feeling very different.
Lexi Clout was born Levi, and those differences she noticed at 4 or 5 intensified as she got older. She was born in a boy's body, but she felt like a girl. Filmmaker Lana Wachowski, born Larry, lived as a man well into her adult life. With her brother Andy, she co-wrote and directed the Matrix trilogy, Cloud Atlas, and more. Lana and her brother are famously private people, not doing any press at all in the last decade or so. She recently broke this silence, returning to the public eye as a woman. Here she speaks at a human rights campaign ceremony held in her honor about growing up transgendered.
I remember the third grade. I remember recently moving and transferring from a public school to a Catholic school. In public school, I played mostly with girls. I have long hair, and everyone wears jeans and t-shirts. In the Catholic school, the girls wear skirts, the boys wear pants. I am told I have to cut my hair. I want to play foursquare with the girls, but now I am one of them. I am one of the boys.
Many people think that gender and sex are the same thing, but they're not connected in the way you might think. Generally, we are all born with a fixed sex. An anatomy that's either male or female, but gender is how we define ourselves.
Early on, I am told to get in line after a morning bell, girls in one line, boys in the other. I walk past the girls, feeling this strange, powerful gravity of association. As soon as I look towards the other line, though, I feel a feeling of differentiation that confuses me. I don't belong there either.
If you're a transgendered child, the differences show up pretty early. Even if your parents allow you to freely express yourself, having long or short hair, dressing how you like, you'll still get sorted into one gender category or another eventually. Most kids do their best to fit in. Laura Gutknecht, born James, remembers knowing long before she had the language to describe it that her body didn't fit who she was, something she couldn't even imagine how to fix.
You know, I kind of went through several phases, and the first one was kind of a magic phase where, you know, I wished on stars and four-leaf clovers and that sort of thing, and it just didn't work, of course. And then I kind of went through a religious phase. For a long time, I was mad at God.
Puberty makes things more complicated. Imagine going through hormone surges, mounting social pressures, and budding sexuality in the wrong body. As transgendered people move into adulthood, many try to deny their identities and live as their born sex. Lexi and Laura each got married. Laura had kids. Lexi worked in the hyper-macho racing industry. But when your life feels like a lie, tension starts to build inside you. At home, you might dress or behave in a way that feels natural to you, but there's enormous pressure to return to your assigned gender role at work or school. For many, there comes a point where the only option left is to come out. And as both Lexi and Laura found, this can come at a terrible cost. Here's Laura.
I grew up in a Catholic family, and I have seven brothers and sisters. And I was, for 5 years, I was ostracized. And no Thanksgiving or Christmases and those kinds of things. So it took a while for them to really come to grips with it.
This happens all too often. Families who can't understand walk away. Laura was already divorced with grown children when she decided to come out. Her ex-wife won't speak to her, but her kids say they always wondered and completely support her. Lana's family accepted her almost at once. She says that
having good parents is just like the lottery. You're just like, oh my God, I won the lottery. What the? I didn't do anything.
Having good siblings is like winning the lottery, too.
A few short weeks ago, after my coming out, three of us, Tom, Andy, and I, were being interviewed. One of the reporters ventured away from the subject of the film towards my gender. My brother quickly stepped in. Look, just so we're clear, he says, if somebody asks something or says something about my sister that I don't like, understand I will break a bottle over their head. Few words express love clearer than these.
After coming out, many trans people choose to start a physical transition. There are hormone treatments to grow facial hair and deepen voices, or to grow breasts and soften skin. Painful electrolysis to remove facial hair, or breast reduction surgery. Then there's the issue of the bathroom. When it comes to gender, public restrooms divide us completely. Opening that doorway with the female icon was a hard moment for Lexi, but her wife Jenny was right at her side.
It was a huge fear at first. I remember like having Jenny like go in bathrooms and shake them down to make sure nobody was in there.
Once I felt like she was presentable, I'm just like, get your butt in there. Now I can't pull her out of the dang place because she's sitting in front of the mirror preening and primping and applying her makeup and her powder. And it's this whole thing is, you know, a testament of extremes. And it's so, I say it over and over again, amazing how far she's come from what she first used to be.
There are many obstacles for transgendered people, from a simple lack of understanding to bigotry to brutal hate crimes. Even parents can be bullies. This is especially tough on teens. The negative voices, along with inner turmoil, can build to a breaking point. According to the National Center for Transgender Equality, nearly 40% of transgendered people will attempt suicide. This is especially true for those under 20. It might not have anything to do with bullying or lack of approval from family. Even if the only one who knows is you, there can be a profound sadness in not fitting in your skin. Every day, you see women or men who are naturally themselves, and it can seem like that will never be you. Here's Lana again.
After school, I go to the nearby Burger King and I write a suicide note. It was addressed to my parents, and I really wanted to convince them that it wasn't their fault. It was just that I didn't belong. I know the train platform will be empty at night because it always is. I let the B train go by because I know the A train will be next and it doesn't stop. When I see the headlight, I take off my backpack and I put it on the bench. It has the note in front of it. I try not to think of anything but jumping. Just as the platform starts to rumble, suddenly I notice someone walking down the ramp. He stares at me the way animals stare at each other. I don't know why he wouldn't look away. All I know is that because he didn't, I am still here.
There's a message here for all of us. We have a choice to make. To be that person who will not look away. To be the parent or friend or relative who understands. Lexi said early on, when you transition, the world transitions with you. And when that goes right, it can open up a whole new universe.
Aubrey Ralph is an independent producer. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Let us go then, you and I, when the evening is spread out against the sky. I've been reading T.S. Eliot, The Love Song of J. Alfred Prufrock, from a copy I bought long ago for a college English course. Did you remember it doesn't start with that line? There's a verse in Italian, which someone must have translated for me 40 years ago, because there it is, in my neat young hand script. If I thought my answer were to one who could return to the world, this flame should shake no more. But since no one did ever return alive from this depth, if what I hear be true, without fear of infamy, I answer thee. Turn the page, and there you are. Let us go then, you and I, as the conscious and unconscious mind begin their colloquy. I was surprised both by how much and how little I remember of the poem. Should that be surprising? Reading Eliot's lines now, they seem to have more meaning, just not the same meaning I would have found then. Scholars would say Eliot was examining a young man's psyche. For me, his words seem older and sadder. In the room the women come and go talking of Michelangelo. The yellow fog that rubs its back upon the window panes. And indeed, there will be time. There. That line. And indeed there will be time. When you're young, there's nothing but time. As you get older, you read into that line the little aches and pains of mourning you either never had or happily ignored years ago. There is promise of time in the line both then and now, but with more sadness now from then. There will be time, there will be time to prepare a face to meet the faces that you meet. That's the line I think more about now. When you're young, you prepare a face for the world. Later, you look at that face and wonder who it is. I think about my dad shooting a basket in the driveway at the age of 92, surprised when the arc stops well short of the basket. The look on his face reflected both what he knew in his mind would happen and what his eyes saw happen. Both of his faces were there, the one he had prepared and used for a successful life, and the one he saw in the mirror. There will be time, there will be time. So I wonder when time changes, when the face you've prepared for the world becomes the new face you see in the mirror. There will be time. There is still time to prepare a face different, perhaps more honest than before. Doesn't matter to me much what Eliot was really writing about. Thousands of scholars, as well as casual readers, wiser and more deeply thoughtful than I, have wondered about that. I'm more focused on being with Eliot when he asked, "Do I dare?" and have been grateful he was there to ask the question. Maybe it's enough that in the room the women come and go, talking of Michelangelo. Innovative dancer and choreographer Sally Gross is now in her late 70s, and though she was one of the dancers who revolted against the Martha Graham School of Modern Dance, she says her most impressive feat was overthrowing something far greater, her own body. She spoke with Steve Paulson about the most fundamental thing we do with it. We breathe.
Because that's what we exist on, is the breath. It's the inhale and the exhale that guarantees us that we're living. And it's only because we're alive that we can even take on the idea of performing.
But how does that translate that into what people would do on a dance floor?
On a dance floor. So if there are no counts to get somewhere, how do you know when to be there? So you're breathing, you can feel the other person breathing, and you get a sense of, this is the moment to go. And then you go. And it's the breath that carries you there.
So you don't necessarily decide this ahead of time. It
Absolutely.
Just kind of happens.
Absolutely, yeah.
I mean, you're really talking about
freedom.
Improvisation here.
I'm talking about improvisation. I'm talking about freedom and risk-taking at once.
Huh. Now, one of the pieces you created was called The Pleasure of Stillness, and there was a documentary film of the same title made about you. What does stillness mean to you?
Stillness comes to mean that there's movement. Within stillness, there is always movement. We think that still is still. There is no still. Because if you're breathing, you're not still. If the fluids in your body are moving, you're not still. So it's even harder to work when you're not moving, to keep the sense of being alive and present. So there's presence in the stillness.
But it's so interesting to hear a dancer talk about stillness because, of course, you know, the first thing that comes to mind with dance is you're moving, which would seem to be
exactly,
the opposite.
Exactly, but everybody would have said that what comes to mind in silence, in music, in sound, is no sound. But, of course, there's sound because there's sound in the room even if your hand is not touching the piano. Thank you, John Cage.
I was just going to ask about this. This sounds so much like John Cage.
But it is John Cage. And those are my principles. This is joy and this is play. And if it isn't joyful and playful, then you shouldn't be doing it. So doing it really means showing up. Just keep doing it without being sure that you know how it's going to all come out.
I'm struck by the words that you use. I mean, you often talk about movement rather than dance. What makes that dance?
Don't ask me. I don't know where the line is drawn. Is there a line anymore? Are there lines? You know, I don't know.
I mean, don't we categorize art? I mean, don't we say, you know, this is you are going to a dance performance and, you know, it's billed as dance and that's what draws people to see it?
You know, I don't really call it that anymore. The people who sometimes where you do your performances may call it a dance performance. I don't even use the word dance concert anymore. You know, the last experiences have actually been in my studio, and I say, you know, doing work in my studio, if you'd like to come and see it, there's room for 18 people. So please make a reservation, and that doesn't cost anything, and we'll be sure you get a little wine before you leave. But remember, you're going to probably, you know, be moved around a little bit. I'm going to, I'm going to pause and rearrange the chairs instead of calling them intermission, you know.
What you, who spent your life in dance or whatever you want to call it, how you think about movement as opposed to someone else who, has no background in this area, who, has maybe sort of never really thought about, how we move in our daily lives.
We would begin with breathing, and we would begin with walking. And generally, if I do a workshop, that's the way it begins. And then we begin with what's known as, what might be called and is called, the four dignities, which are basic activities that we do, which is really all we do in life, except we sometimes extend it. So what the example of that is that we basically lie down, then you learn to sit up, then you learn to stand up, and then you learn to walk. And that's basically all we're doing. So
that's life,
those four things. So walking then becomes running if you do it a little faster. It becomes leaping if you take it off the floor. So that's the way I begin when I start working with people, whether it's a mixture of performers, and I do this with the dancers all the time who I work with. I do it with myself. And just yesterday, a woman who's a writer who knows a lot about movement said, I've been spending too much time in a chair. I need something to get me moving. What should I do? I said, work with the four dignities, because every change you make is a change, and every change, be it most subtle. So if you're sitting and you simply turn yourself to the left or the right, or you move an arm, you've made a change and you've moved a part of the body. So how do you go from lying down to sitting up? And you don't have to do it all in, quickly. You don't have to do it slowly. But then you could decide that you want to do it quicker and slower, and you get the body flowing and the movement flowing, and then you can take it up on your feet, and then you can do the same activities, lying, standing, sitting, and walking on your feet. So if you say to somebody, lie down, and they're standing up, they'll probably tip over. Well, that's fine. That's lying down. That's where I begin everything.
Do you think most of us just don't really think about our bodies, or not aware of our bodies?
Absolutely. I think we think we really are all in our minds, and we really separate the body from the mind. There are just the people who are just mind people, and you don't have to look in the mirror, to talk to somebody about their body. Some of us never look in the mirror and still love the body.
What changes then once we gain this knowledge of our bodies?
Then you can become a whole person, because then you have a body and a mind, and that's what we have. That's what people have that all animals don't have. We do have a mind. We can make choices, and we have a body. And we are the body that stands on two feet, which is extraordinary, that these little feet are holding up this enormous structure. And if we don't take care of it, who will take care of it?
Dancer and choreographer Sally Gross speaking with Steve Paulson. To see the critically acclaimed one-hour documentary about her life, go to ttbook.org. This hour we've been talking about our bodies, but before we go, we're going to shift gears, because we're fascinated with a new book by David Stockman. Stockman? Yeah, Stockman. President Reagan's budget director, David Stockman. One of the architects of supply-side economics. He's back in the limelight after all these years with a best-selling book, The Great Deformation. Steve Paulson sat down with him.
Okay, Mr. Stockman, here is a challenge for you. In 1 minute, tell us how you would solve the U.S. economic problems.
Well, that's a tall order, because the problem has been building for 20 or 30 years, even longer. So the first thing I would do would be to fundamentally reform the Fed, shut down this huge bond buying program they have, and go back to the original idea of the Fed from 1914 when Carter Glass, the great senator from Virginia, created it first. Second, I would get incumbents out of politics. We are so dominated by money politics and PACs and K Street and special interest lobbies and then the Citizen United decision that unless we have sweeping reform, we're never going to get out of the mess we're in today where special interests dominate our political process and the people of America are left behind.
You are proposing strict term limits, 6 years, and that's it for the president and a lot of other people. And then once you finish, you're never allowed to lobby for the rest of your life.
We would have in this system of one term, 6 years, no incumbency, public funding only of campaigns. No PACs, no labor union money, no corporations, no rich guys or even average guys, just an 8-week election period funded solely by public money. And then whoever is chosen for the House or the Senate in the district in question has 6 years to get the job done and then move back to private life where they came from. It would be a radical change. We don't have democracy. We basically have sort of a money-driven, crony capitalist form of government that I think is failing the country badly.
One of the counterarguments is that it takes a while to learn how the system works. When Obama first came in, it seemed like it took at least a year for him to kind of figure out how Washington works. You go back through history with a lot of the other presidents, and it seems to be the same thing. And I guess the danger would be, they're finally figuring out how it works, and then they're out.
Well, that's the myth that Washington peddles in order to keep the incumbency system alive. I was a congressman. I spent 20 years in Washington, and I just don't believe it.
You know what I find so striking about what you're saying? I mean, really taking on the entrenched political system and your larger point that the financial system is in bed with the political system is that's also what you hear from a lot of the people who've been part of the Occupy Wall Street movement as well as a lot of the people in the Tea Party. I mean, that's part of their critique on kind of across the political spectrum.
Yeah, and the interesting thing about your observation is the Occupy people and the Tea Party people come at it from an issue angle. They don't obviously agree on many things, but they do not come at it from a party and partisan point of view. And that gets to my larger point, and that is I think political parties have failed completely. And today, political parties are essentially glorified concierges. Their job is mainly to introduce politicians to money, get them tickets to re-election, so to speak.
I want to talk some about your own history because this is part of the
sure.
fascinating piece of the story here. You were actually once a Marxist in Harvard's Divinity School, where you say you enrolled to avoid the Vietnam draft. You were strongly anti-war at that time. Then you became, the live-in babysitter for Democratic Senator Daniel Patrick Moynihan?
Yes, that's right.
And then you ended up working for President Reagan.
Well, it's not as quite as strange as it may sound. In the 1960s, mid-60s, all young people thought the war in Vietnam was a catastrophic mistake, and not only that, but totally wrong. Why were we raining destruction and napalm and fire on innocent people living in villages up and down the coast of Vietnam? It was because of some stupid domino theory that even then, people could see it didn't make sense. So I got into political life protesting the war in Vietnam. I was a member of SDS. I was 19 years old. And when you see your country doing something like that, you obviously think the worst. I then went to Harvard Divinity School. I needed a job. I was hired as a babysitter, live-in babysitter, by Pat Moynihan. And here's the reason I'm bringing it up. He was not yet a Democratic senator. He was Richard Nixon's chief domestic advisor in the White House.
Of course, Moynihan later became a Democratic senator.
Okay. So there are, politics twists and turns in unexpected directions, and clearly some of what we're talking about here has that element.
You were at the highest reaches of power in this country. I mean, you budget director of the Reagan administration. Then you worked on Wall Street. I mean, you worked for the yes. Solomon Brothers. You worked at Blackstone Group, one of the founders there. You were a private right. equity right. investor. I mean, you were at the center of power, both financial power and political power, and you know, which raises the question, were you part of the problem?
Everybody who's part of this generation and looks back at the mess that we've created, the baby boom generation, and the amount of debt that we've left our country with, and you know, the awful legacy that the next generation will have to grapple with, and it won't be easy, and it won't be the kind of false prosperity that we've had for the last couple of decades, shouldn't feel very good about that. So everyone, including myself, should have some real regrets about what has happened over the recent decades. But I do feel that when I was in the White House and I realized quickly, you know, within 6 months of the Reagan inauguration, that we were getting way off track, I did try to warn about that. I was severely criticized by the ideologues for betraying the principles of the Reagan Revolution and all that. But we did correct some of the problems, but I couldn't stop the defense buildup. President Reagan just ignored any information about that didn't come from the generals and Cap Weinberger. So we had a massive defense buildup we shouldn't have had. We put taxes too low to really pay the bills of government. And despite all the speeches about big government that he constantly gave after the first couple years, very little was done to change it. I did what I could, but finally I left in 1985 because I couldn't justify any longer the policy that was being pursued. And after the 84 election, in which, you know, it was mourning in America and all that, and had all this triumphalism ascendant in the White House, you know, that is something that I really couldn't abide. I couldn't justify or defend any longer. So it wasn't as if I didn't try to make a difference.
David Stockman was President Reagan's budget director. He was also one of the architects of supply-side economics. His book is called The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. Steve Paulson spoke with him. If you're curious and you want to hear the complete 40-minute interview, you'll find it on our website at ttbook.org. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. For more uncut interview and transcripts and a list of our books and music, just head on over to the website. You can follow us on Facebook, too, and on Twitter. The handle's at ttbook1. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This hour was produced by Charles Monroe Kane with the help of Doug Gordon, Sarah Nix, and Ann Strainchamps. TT Book theme remix by Joe Hartke. Special thanks to audio engineer Brittany True. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.